Are you looking for ways to attract and retain private pay clients? Thrizer is a payment platform for therapists built to help clients automatically tap into their out-of-network benefits and save on therapy up front. Check out our special link, join.thrizer.com/modern therapist, and use the code modernTherapists to activate $2,500 in free payments with Thrizer.
Simplified SEO Consulting has DIY done with you training and done for you SEO options. So there is truly something to fit every practice owner's SEO needs. Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern therapist and use the code modern therapist for a DIY course or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your consult for special offers.
You're listening to the Modern Therapist Survival Guide, where therapists live, breathe, and practice as human beings. To support you as a whole person and a therapist, here are your hosts, Kurt Widhelm and Katie Vernoy.
Welcome back, Modern Therapists. This is the Modern Therapist Survival Guide. I'm Kurt Widhelm with Katie Vernoy, and this is the podcast that deals with all sorts of things related to therapists in our lives, in our practices, and the world around us. And it's been a little bit more than a year since we've talked about some of the Middle East culture stuff. And we had a wonderful podcast last year around this time. And surprise, surprise, prejudice and racism against clients and people from that kind of the world hasn't gone away in the last 12 months. And so talking about some of the background, we're joined today by Dr. Sheila Modier, and she is here to share with us about the experiences of prejudice and discrimination against Middle Eastern, North African American community members. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I love your podcast. I love listening to it. I'm really excited to be here today and talk about this topic.
We are excited to have you here too. You're a friend of the show. And so it's so wonderful that you're willing to share your knowledge with us, so other people can know you just like we do. Who are you and what are you putting out into the world?
I am a pediatric psychologist at Chalk Children's, which is a children's hospital in Southern California. I'm also an Iranian American. Just to tell you a little bit about my background, I have my master's in social work from UCLA. And then I went on and I got my PhD at UC Santa Barbara in a combined degree, which is like clinical counseling and school psychology, but I got an emphasis in clinical psychology. And that's when I really started getting into the research on discrimination, racial socialization, which I would love to also talk about too. And specifically started really looking at the Middle Eastern and North African community, which I'll call MENA for short, and just really the different layers of racial trauma that they've experienced.
So we've moved this question up to the front of the show, and I think that we're probably far enough having moved this question up in the show to stop giving that disclaimer to help therapists not make the same mistakes that other people have already made. So as a learning point, what do you think that therapists get wrong when working with MENA clients?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the challenge is that therapists really don't know much about MENA clients, or they confuse the Muslim culture with the MENA culture. And the MENA culture is actually, it's very diverse. You have the Jewish community, you have Catholic, you have Christian, you have Islam, but then you also have people in Israel and people in North Africa. And then you have the Arabic countries, and then you have Iran and Turkey and Afghanistan. So you just have all these different pieces of the Middle East. And unfortunately, we really don't have a lot of data on the MENA community. Middle Easterners have immigrated to the US since the 1890s, and we don't really have an exact population count. And the reason for that is because the US Census actually taxonomically categorizes them as white Caucasian. So we don't really know exactly what their experience is, and we can't capture it. So how that's really problematic is we don't have clinical research. We can't really make therapeutic considerations based off of this population. We also can't track health trends. So with COVID-19, we don't know exactly what's happening with the MENA community. So basically, they're really lost in the shuffle of things. So if you're really thinking about, okay, how does this impact therapy? Well, again, if we can't do the research, then we really don't know what's going on with them. And everything that people are doing right now is very foundational. And we're just starting to, this new generation of MENA psychologists are just starting to really look into this population. I think one of the few people that have accurately captured the MENA community is in Dr. Sue's book on multicultural counseling. There's a few chapters in there. And I remember even being in graduate school, the only time I really learned about the MENA community was from those few chapters that were assigned to be able to look through. So I think if we all reflect back on our graduate training, how much did we really get to know about the MENA community? I think probably very little. And I do attribute that to the fact that they're ultimately a very invisible community, which is very ironic because they're very much under scrutiny and surveillance, but then they also are very much overlooked on a lot of different levels.
It's interesting to be invisible yet scrutinized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're definitely under the eye in terms of the negative things, right? So when you go to the airport or anytime you are some sort of terrorist attack happens, you know, all eyes are on the Middle East and talked about and it's paid attention to. But then when we want to know exactly like how is the mental health of this community or how many Middle Easterners are residing in the US, we really don't have that information.
I mean, it seems to me, and one of the areas of expertise that you have is around racial trauma. I think it seems to me there would be so many different layers of racial trauma that the MENA community is experiencing. And I feel like we're starting to know, but maybe we don't even have the basic information. But what do we know about the racial trauma experienced in the MENA community?
Okay, this is definitely a great question because I have a ton of research on this piece because this was actually my own research, was on the multiple layers of racial trauma. So please interject and stop me because I'm very passionate about this topic. I can go on. So there's multiple layers. So what I want us to imagine is really Bronfenbrenner's ecological model and really the concentric circles that he has in really looking at the different layers that people experience. So I use that model for racial trauma. And what we first found in the literature and within our analysis of the data was that there's a socio-political level of discrimination that occurs. And then it goes into community, relational, and individual, which I'm happy to get into. But socio-political is really interesting because it really started after 9/11, where a lot of the MENA community was forced to make this choice of whether you're Western or you're Eastern. And for some people, it really wasn't much of a choice because the Western community was very much saying, well, you physically look MENA, so we're going to discriminate against you. And you're part of this other group as opposed to being part of us, even though this population, a subset was born within the US and felt like they were patriotic. But if we remember it after 9/11, it was patriotic to be against the MENA community, to make sure that you were outwardly expressing that.
Even on that point, I remember this is, you know, the highest levels of cinema, but I remember seeing an interview with some actors who had been on an Adam Sandler movie who were like, oh, you want us to play cab drivers after 9/11? Like they were so excited to not play terrorists in movies that it had permeated just so many different areas of the culture.
Yes, that's exactly. So that's perfect intro to the next piece of that. The next layer of sociopolitical climate is the media's influence. You're exactly right. So they were very much vilified. So all the, if we recall, all the bad guys in the movie spoke Arabic.
Yeah.
You know, that we were very far from our days of Aladdin. We were now moving towards things like there was shows about terrorism. There were shows about Arabic graffiti in the background. The Middle East was portrayed as war-torn and everybody there was burning American flags. I mean, any sort of villain essentially after 9/11 was seen as Middle Eastern. And that's really hard for a group of people that are growing up in this generation, A, for that to be all that they've known, and B, for example, to sit in a cinema and watch the bad guy and be like, oh, I understand his language. I know everything he's saying, you know, I understand it perfectly. And so I think that's very, very impactful on how this community is really grown up to see the world. And ultimately on the sociopolitical level, the final thing that really came out that I think was the most devastating finding was that all the participants at some point had been called terrorists. And to have your culture so tied to such a horrific thing and to find it very normal to be like, oh yes, I've been called terrorist. Yeah, but they were joking, or even if they weren't joking, you know, I understand why they would say that because of the political climate, or at the time that I was gathering my data, a lot of the ISIS murders were happening and ISIS terrorist attacks. I think it's just very unfortunate because if we simultaneously compare this to actual terrorists like Dylann Roof, or who actually did terrorize, you know, the Black community and is a mass murderer and a white supremacist. But instead of him being labeled as a terrorist, he was labeled as a lone wolf, someone that had a mental illness, as opposed to when a terrorist attack has occurred, the entire MENA community is now responsible for this attack. And I think that that's something that the media does, is it takes one person's action, and especially for ethnic minority communities, and makes it a representation for the entire cultural group.
With the insurrection that happened at the U.S. Capitol at the beginning of January, and even the language that's initially been used around this, the insurrection, the coup, starting to hear more regularly about this being called white terrorism. We had our episode last month that was about white terrorism. How are people from the MENA community responding to this now that the limelight is on white people doing this? But there has to be some kind of, I don't know, observation that seems to be maybe a little bit different here.
Definitely. I think right now a lot of what is coming out is very anecdotal. I think it's very different for every person as they're taking in the information that's coming in. But overall, I believe this is one of the first few times that we are seeing the label of white terrorism being thrown around to describe the awful events that had occurred that day. And I think that it's a very fitting label, because in your episode on white terrorism, you know, you had the FBI definition of what terrorism is. And I think that for so long, when people imagine what a terrorist is, unfortunately, they are picturing a Middle Eastern or someone from the MENA community. And I believe that the events that had occurred at the Capitol for the first time shed light that other groups, including the majority group in the US, the Caucasian white group, can be labeled as white terrorism. But I think that we're all still holding our breath to see what the consequences of that event will be, and if this community will also continue with this label, because I do think that we are hearing different labels. So ultimately, I can't really say what the Middle Eastern community is feeling about this, but I do believe that we are at a place right now that we are labeling accurately events as terrorism in the U.S.
Thrizer is a payment platform designed for out-of-network therapy. As a therapist, you would use Thrizer to charge clients for sessions and collect your full rate upfront. From the client's perspective, Thrizer links to their health plan, so insurance claims are automatically submitted for them upon every charge. From there, Thrizer manages the claims end-to-end so that your clients don't have to worry about manually submitting super bills or getting on calls with insurance. The best part? Thrizer allows clients to only pay their co-insurance portion for sessions, while Thrizer covers the rest of your fee and waits for reimbursement on their behalf.
They also offer you an instant benefits calculator for free, allowing you to provide upfront transparency to prospective clients on their out-of-network coverage. Therapists only pay a standard 3% credit card processing fee per session with no additional fees. Visit join.thrizer.com/modern therapist to get started and use our promo code Modern Therapists to receive $2,500 in waived fees for your sessions.
Are there particular backgrounds, or are there particular people within the MENA community who are more at risk of this kind of discrimination or these kinds of microaggressions?
Or full-on aggression.
Or full-on aggression.
Calling someone a terrorist isn't a microaggression.
Yeah. From what we found in our data, it was physical appearance, you know, has a really big component to it. So whether you are dressed in like an Islamic hijab, or even if the darker skin tones that you have are participants that what we call racially passed. So you pass for the Caucasian white group. They were the ones that experienced much less of it. But, you know, there are identifying factors like in your name or how you say your name or different things like that, that they were much more discriminated against. Having an accent, all of these things were things that came out in the literature.
And you were talking about like, oh, I understand why they called me a terrorist, and it was kind of just taken in stride. I mean, does it feel like it is socially acceptable, broadly socially acceptable, for this type of racism to occur?
I think so. That's actually interesting, because there another concept that came out of the data was this thing called cultural ignorance. So we're looking at the concentric circles. We have sociopolitical discrimination, we have institutional discrimination, and then we have something called relational discrimination. And within relational discrimination, there was a concept of cultural ignorance that was coded in the data, because these participants would say, yes, I experienced discrimination, but it's ignorance. They didn't mean it. It's because there was this lack of knowledge on the MENA community. If these participants are college students, they're like 18, and they would say things like, you know, if you go back to our history classes, we never learned about the MENA community. So how could I expect my peers to learn about it? And now that I'm in college, my own college does not recognize me as a minority community or doesn't have events that highlight my cultural group. So how are they supposed to get this knowledge? They're coming from their homes into college and they are, you know, doing or saying maybe what their parents have told them or what they've seen in the media. So what we realized is that the coping skill for discrimination for the MENA community, one of their major things was to A, avoid any sort of backlash, and B, to get used to it. So we kept coding the word getting used to it. I'm just used to it. It happens. I'm just used to it. It's not that big of a deal. The minimization. And previous literature actually has found that the MENA community does tend to, and Marvesty, which is one of the researchers, said they tend to cower or resign in the face of discrimination, which definitely was something that came out a lot. And it's very, very sad, because if you do not address something as discriminatory, then others won't recognize it as discriminatory and will continue to do it. And then this will soon become this ignored problem that's never addressed and will just accumulate. And what we ultimately realized is that, yes, you can avoid, and yes, you can get used to it, but you're still carrying the psychological distress of the discrimination. That doesn't go away. So the participants still felt depression, anxiety, and all of these mental health concerns, despite using these methods of coping skills that they thought were effective for them.
So how do they cope? Other than internalizing everybody else's ignorance and intolerance, how are people from the MENA community coping with this, other than just kind of in this nebulous, like, deal with it?
Yeah, and I think this is a great question for therapists to know, because when we were talking about, like, what do they know? What do we know about it? And I think coping skills, we're always, you know, referring to that as therapists. So there's different ways that they cope. And one is by being educators and by being representatives of their cultural group. Since the media isn't doing it, the community has taken it upon themselves. So one of the quotes that I had from a participant say, like, if they think that I'm an uneducated Arab, I want to show them that I'm an educated Arab. I want to teach them about the beauty of my culture. So many of them don't see it as like, oh, I have to, because I'm a minority, I have to educate others. It's felt like this group was taking power and taking pride in being a cultural representative and really wanting to break those stereotypes. The next piece was avoidance. So due to that fear of backlash, so I better not say anything. And one of the things that really influenced that was messages from their families. So a lot of these participants were talking about how when they went off to college, their parents were saying things like, you know, don't be too Arab, don't speak Arabic or, you know, Farsi, try to blend in, you know. And also every time a terrorist attack occurred, everybody was holding their breath. You know, I remember when a lot of the basis of my research was actually based off of how I emotionally experienced the Boston bombing and how there's that period where we just didn't know who it was and the whole country was waiting. And it was awful. And I just remember every MENA person that I ran into that day was just like, please pray that it's not a Middle Easterner. Like, please, if there's anything we can do. And I was like, oh my goodness, like, this level of stress is like, A, my country is under attack, and now I have to be stressed because I don't want it to be someone from my culture. That's just the psychological toll that takes on a person is just so extreme. And that's really what I was like, I need to understand this. I need to know, like, why do we think this way? And how are we coping with this? And then the final thing is too, that this is a community that actually enjoys working towards being a model minority. The literature has found that with Asian American communities, that's actually something that they don't like being identified as. And so it's interesting to see that the MENA community found it as something that they did strive for. And I think that they're just constantly pushing back against this negative depiction. And I do think that 9/11 was that date that forever really made that community change.
So this is kind of pulling it into I'm channeling Kurt and I'm pulling it into the therapist education realm. But I'm for me, a therapist, and kind of this desire to make sure that education is occurring and combating the cultural ignorance. How is it for you? How has it been for your MENA colleagues to start trying to address this in a more comprehensive way?
I think that it's been actually a very supportive experience right now. I think that there's this new generation of psychologists that are in graduate school from the MENA community. We actually have a listserv or division within the American Psychological Association called AMENA Psych, which I really recommend people joining because this is the first ever organization for MENA that are in the mental health field. And I think that there's been a lot of collaboration. And I think most recently people, you know, emailing about, you know, this is my research, can you promote it? And so I do think that we're at this excellent time where foundational research is being done, that I feel like in the next decade or so, we will have more information about this community. I think ultimately what we do need to change is getting ourselves on the census and being our own category.
So I've seen here in the last week that the Biden-Harris administration is looking to specifically identify MENA on the census, at least as one of the steps. And on one end of the spectrum, I hear people like you who are like, this is fantastic and research, and it's going to open up all sorts of avenues to understand us as a distinct community. And on the other end of the spectrum, I'm hearing there is no way in hell that I want the government to have any other reason. And so this fear is even beyond the interpersonal interactions that people are having, but also to that political interaction that I guess it just speaks to there really is a broad experience even within this community of the level of trust and mistrust to American culture.
I mean, can we blame them? We have everything that's ever happened in the Middle East is somehow, we've got America's hands tied into it somehow. So I think there's that component of it. And then also, what was one of Trump's first initiatives? The Muslim ban, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and so from there, it's terrifying. I think that there's going to have to be a lot of trust rebuilt in a lot of minority communities right now, especially after the current administration. I think that a lot of Latino communities are also worried about putting down their ethnicity. And I think that this is just something that's going to be rebuilt over time. For the MENA community, a lot of celebrities have come together that have been trying to say, you know, don't be scared, put it down. But I will say personally, you know, I had to spend some time convincing my own parents to do it because, you know, they're worried about what could happen, even though they're US citizens. I think that I don't think it's really the current administration was even talking about, you know, people that are born here, but still have parents from another country might get deported. I mean, there's just so much talk that had happened these past 4 years that it's really scared people.
So when we're supporting MENA clients in our therapy spaces, what is it most important for us to know and for us to keep in mind as we're walking through therapy with them?
Yeah, that's a really great question because I think I can speak from at least the discrimination piece. And if we're looking at discrimination, it's their whole interaction with the world, right? And on multiple levels, I think we want to remember as therapists that this is a community that will minimize, will deny, and tends to be very private and not disclose these things because they don't maybe want to be a nuisance in any sort of way or want to see that as problematic. And we still need to assess for it. We need to ask about it. We cannot shy away from the uncomfortable dialogue related to race and racism because what we're finding in the literature is that this is a community that will be quiet about it, but will carry it and it will influence them. And I think the most powerful thing that I found in my research was that when we looked at the multiple levels of discrimination, ultimately how it impacted the individual was so powerful. On a social level, this group, at least 80%, gravitated toward joining cultural and religious organizations within their first year of college. That's huge for students to do. You know, so that means that they wanted to go back to their cultural roots. So they just left home, maybe getting away from parents, and now they were feeling lost and needed a sense of belonging within their community. So sense of belonging is huge in this community. on an academic level, a majority of them were choosing careers that we would consider prestigious, like being a professor or a physician or an engineer. In addition to that, a majority of them were minoring or double majoring in Middle Eastern studies. There is this thirst for appropriate and accurate knowledge on their culture that the media has not provided for them and that they have not been able to find out there. Even I was in graduate program and I was taking Middle Eastern studies. And that's how I was like, wait, what's going on? Like, how did we all find each other here and form this community? And I think, again, that for universities is huge to know that academically, this group of people really is seeking this out. And then on an emotional level, this was a group that would say things like, I'm angry that I'm being discriminated against, but I do not want to confirm the stereotype of an angry Arab. You know, I don't want people to think like, oh, you're mad. Are you going to go bomb a place right now? You know, and that's what people would say if there was some sort of emotional expression. So there is this emotional repression that's occurring around discrimination, around these experiences that they're having out in the world. And as therapists, it's our job to start unraveling and supporting and processing things that they might not even be recognizing that they're carrying.
Simplified SEO Consulting's team of mental health professionals genuinely want to help you attract more of your ideal clients with a proven on-page SEO process using the strategies that are most effective for therapist websites. They know SEO is an investment, which is why it is so important to find someone who aligns with your values and understands the importance of building your private practice in a meaningful way. Simplified SEO Consulting hopes to be that team for you and your practice.
The expert team would love to talk with you during a free consultation to figure out the best fit for your SEO journey. Simplified SEO Consulting has DIY, done with you training, and done for you SEO options. So there's truly something to fit every practice owner's SEO needs. Be sure to ask if their innovative content network is a good fit for your website. Listeners of this podcast can get 20% off a DIY SEO course with code MODERNTHERAPIST or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your free consultation for $100 off your done-for-you SEO program onboarding this spring.
Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern-therapist. With a MENA client working with a non-MENA therapist, is there advice there? Because I can hear the affinity groups and being able to really to gain more education and knowledge around culture and kind of finding your way home, so to speak. I think when you're talking about this need to stay quiet or this need to get used to it or get along, I could imagine looking at a white person, because you know, I'm a white person, and having someone be like, I don't know that she's going to get it, or this could hurt my relationship, or those types of things. Like, is there, obviously maybe this is a big ask, but is there a way for non-MENA therapists to be able to show some solidarity, some comfort, some ability to say, hey, I'm here and you can open up to me?
Yeah, I do. I think that definitely. And there is literature that says that the MENA community is comfortable seeking out non-MENA therapists. At the same time, there is some that say that they're not comfortable. And so things I think to keep in mind is just finding whatever cultural information that you can and really being able to understand the culture. Like if we want to be culturally competent therapists, then we need to enrich ourselves or into this information like we do with all other ethnic minority cultures, right? And so there is some literature out there, but there's also some things to kind of realize with working with the MENA population. And that is really being able to just say exactly what you said of like, you know, I might not recognize your experiences or not understand them, but I would like to know, you know, I know that something has happened, you know, in the US or overseas. I heard this thing on the news. Is this impacting your family in any way? I think what we did deem from the data was that they're not offended. And so if some cultures might or communities might be offended, they're not offended by asking or probing about these things and putting them in a position of educating. We want to be careful because we don't want, for example, the Black community to have to educate us on Black culture. We should know these things or the Latinx community. But I think with the MENA community, because there isn't a lot of literature out there, I think it's okay for us to ask and inquire and further explore and let them maybe teach us a little bit about what they're going through. And really we can attribute it to the fact that there isn't much out there. But just general things for therapists to be aware of too, is that this is a collectivistic culture. So when you have an individual patient in the room, you can actually feel like the whole family is in the room with you because mm-hmm. they're very much like present, even though they're not physically there. The oldest son, the fathers, you know, those, they definitely could be the ultimate decision maker, similar with Latinx families. So there is some overlap there. I actually did a lot of research on Latinx families because I was interested in collectivistic cultures, and I found that there was a lot of cultural overlap. So I do think that therapists that are looking for understanding the MENA community can look at just collectivism in general to help support them with that. The MENA community tends to go to their physicians for mental health problems. So there might be a lot of physician referrals, and a lot of somatic complaints when it's really maybe anxiety. So just different things like that to be aware of. I do think that the Middle East has grown in their acceptance of therapy so much more. I know that in Iran right now, there is acceptance commitment therapy conferences that a lot of young people attend. And there's just different like CBT and ACT genres that have like really grown. I know that in Egypt, like PCIT is starting to maybe be implemented. So I do think that as the Middle East kind of becomes more accepting of Western models of therapy, I think that we can definitely see them opening up more within the US with non-MENA therapists.
One of the associates who's been working in my practice is Iranian. Mm-hmm. She's been on one of our previous podcast episodes as well. And some of the things that she talks about is just to the levels of understanding the collective cultural aspects is the Western approaches of therapy having so much with the individual efforts towards interventions that, you know, why don't you stand up to your family? Well, that just doesn't work in a MENA household. And my point in this is that it does take a understanding of how this applies. It's not just applying West to collectivist cultures. It's really getting into the understanding of how that relationship plays out, because otherwise we can be well-intentioned, but still completely off the mark.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's being sensitive to that every decision is run by the family and run past the family. I think that where we can definitely support in what we're giving in terms of the individualistic components of our therapy, because we want to help them with the distress that they're experiencing. But I do think that things like setting boundaries, right? It's such a Western component to what we're doing. But I feel like if boundary setting is needed in terms of the fact that their functioning is impaired due to poor boundaries, I think there are ways to make it culturally sensitive and be able to apply. But yeah, I think it's definitely a line that we walk. But fortunately for us, there's similar communities that have the same cultural backgrounds, right? Asian Americans, Latinx, MENA communities, they are very collectivistic. The decisions have to be run past families. They work together towards common goals. You know, the elderly often live within the family unit. So these are things that we can definitely consider when we are looking at Western approaches like CBT and ACT. I think we're trying to change the individual, but we're not trying to change the context that they're residing in. So it's almost like working in to impact the outside, if that makes sense.
It does. And it makes me think about some of the clients that I have that are from more of a kind of a collectivist culture, but are also pushing back on it and kind of the Eastern versus Western situation. And so I think it's something where, you know, I hear this oftentimes, and a lot of the conversations that we have is that it's not a monolithic group, but it's important to understand kind of the larger picture so that you can see where someone fits within that culture, because someone could be more individualist within a collectivist culture. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that could be part of the conflict. And if you're going like, go individualism, and not understanding that this is a huge piece, a huge, you know, rift in the family and in the kind of, even for them understanding how it works, I think it just is, it's really rich to be able to have that information so that you understand the full context, not just how it fits into your own lived experience and Western culture. I guess the question that falls here is kind of what are the resources and support and the different things that therapists can use when working with MENA clients?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Unfortunately, I don't have an answer for that because there really is not that much out there. And I think, again, we're speaking to the fact that we are still in the foundational part of gathering data, providing for this community. And this, again, even in our therapeutic world, this is a group that's being overlooked and we don't have the resources that we should have to be able to support this community.
And if there is a call to action on that piece, while people like Sheila are developing that research and doing it in the more scientific way, there is a huge space for anecdotal and case studies to be developed in the meantime. And if you are a MENA therapist, if you are working with MENA clients, write that stuff down and share that with the rest of us of what's working and what particularly works maybe with some people, what doesn't work. Because in the absence of a deep history of research and background information, anything helps. Even if it's kind of only right, that is something that does help our whole community end up being able to build from there and have a better collective knowledge of being able to serve all of our clients and our therapists coming from this background.
Definitely. I agree. The more case studies, the better.
Where can people find out more about you?
You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Sheila Modir. I also have an Instagram handle called The Little Wellness Bookshelf, where I list children's books that promote themes of diversity and mental health in order to build resilience in children, as I am a pediatric psychologist. And also my husband and I have actually written a children's book called The Proudest Color, which is coming out in September, and we're really excited about it. It's about a young girl of color who experiences discrimination, and we used racial socialization theory and evidence-based practices to help her navigate this experience. It's a timely, sensitive introduction to race, racism, and racial pride. And all the author proceeds will be donated to causes and organizations that promote equity and social justice. So I will definitely provide you with all that information.
That's amazing.
Thank you.
And we'll include links to those on our show notes. You can find those at mtsgpodcast.com. And while you're over there, check out all of the wonderful things that Katie and I are doing with all of our other various projects. And until next time, I'm Kurtwood Helm with Katie Vernoy and Dr. Sheila Modir. Remember to check out Thrizer. They are passionate about making out-of-network therapy work for everyone. Clients save upfront on therapy while therapists earn their full rate. Get started in minutes on join.thrizer.com/modern therapist and use the promo code Modern Therapists and receive $2,500 in waived fees for your sessions.
Don't forget, we have some special offers from our partner, Simplified SEO Consulting. Get 20% off a DIY SEO course with the code Modern Therapist or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your free consultation for $100 off of your onboarding to the Done For You SEO program. Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern therapist.
Thank you for listening to the Modern Therapist Survival Guide. Learn more about who we are and what we do at mtsgpodcast.com. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. And please don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any of our episodes.